Introducing Manor Wisdom Quintet!
Skipped a week. Did I skip 2 weeks? I don't remember. I skipped some time and I'm going to skip some more time. I don't have any interviews at the moment. It's not for lack of interest or lack of people saying yes or anything like that. It's just that I don't have time. I don't have time. It's great and it's bad all at the same time, because even like as I record this yesterday, I had nothing to do this weekend, and then at around 5:30, I had stuff to do all day today. So, professionally speaking, not like at the house, although I do have a honey-do list. But it's great. The Blake Minor design thing has been going really, really well. I'm already starting to line things up for next school year, which means, and if the person that needed to hear this, who I've been playing phone tag with for a little bit now, is just now hearing this, which means I'm not going to go back to the classroom next year. I'm going to stay independent. I'm going to stay self-employed for at least another school year and see how it goes. Just give it a full year, give it a full school year to see how this works. And my accountant, you know, I have to file taxes every quarter now, so four times a year. And not like end of year taxes kind of thing. What I do is you pay the IRS an estimate based on your income. And even my accountant, who's been my accountant for a very long time because it's one of my sister's best friends, she was like, "You made this much in this quarter?" And apparently I did. And it's, I mean, look, I talked about this with Clay Van Winkle a while back. He said, "Yes, you make pretty good money, but you're still not going out buying cars and big houses and things like that. You're making better than teaching money, but you're still not breaking the bank by any means. And I'm not raising any red flags at Fidelity, or my investments aren't skyrocketing, right? So it's not like that, but it is better than teaching. I'll say that. You just have to keep up with more stuff. I say you have to keep up with different stuff, maybe not more stuff. Teaching is 90% paperwork and 10% teaching, but you have to keep up with different stuff. It's a different mentality, different day-to-day work that you do have to do. It's not just making your calendar and going on your merry way to make some money. But all that said, I'm 98% sure that Blake Minor Design will still be a thing next year, and I'm not going to go back to the classroom, so unbreak my heart. Anyway, I'm not going to do any interviews until May, because my April is booked solid with dance shows and different events at different schools and such. So this is going to be the last one for the next few weeks, and then I'll come back and I'll do some summer pods, even though the summer's kind of slow for me, but I can at least line up a bunch of summer interviews. And I am at the moment planning on being at Summerfest TXETA in what, 2 months? 2 months from today, I guess, as I record this. But and I am bringing my gear. And every time I go to these things, I don't interview people. So I'm telling you now, if you're going to Summerfest, I will probably awkwardly stop you and try to interview you. Not like another podcast host used to do, where they just set a microphone on a table and hit record without you knowing. But I'm going to get consent. Speaking of other podcasts, there's one that's done, apparently. Mine is not going anywhere. I may be slowing down as I scratch my back, but I'm not going anywhere. And so I'm going to continue to keep going with interviews and such. Again, like I said, but I'm going to slow down some. A couple of things. First of all, well, I guess second of all, now that I'm 4 minutes into a conversation here with myself, I want to do a shout out to... There are quite a few theater teachers that are struggling really hard with medical diagnosis, and some things have been posted online about their medical diagnosis. They've posted these things, or family has, or something like that. And I just, you know, I'm not really much of a praying person, but I do think about I hope these people are okay, and all this kind of stuff. So those theater teachers that are struggling, those theater teachers that have things that are happening to them that they have no control over, I just want to give you guys a shout out, and I hope you kick out. And that's a wrestling term, but I hope you do kick out and everything is fine and you continue on your merry way of being a force in the world of theater education and just a force in the world, because it's heartbreaking. It's really, really heartbreaking. I don't know how to kind of transition into some other things, but UIL season is almost over. People, as I again record today, are ending areas. I think areas are pretty much over as of today, and then it's on to region. So congratulations to those people that are advancing to region. Shout out to BOBBY. But it's called region, not regionals. So if you're posting that your school advanced to regionals, it's region. I don't think we've ever called it regionals. I think that's like a swim, gymnastics, dance term. So it is region. I don't think any paperwork says regionals, but just that's my little soapbox. Just, you know, hit that edit button, take off the ALS, and go from there, okay? Sounds good, yeah. So the UIL season was really good for me. I had a contest managed 5 contests, but I was a part of 7 contests technically, and it was a lot of fun. And I saw some really good shows. I saw some repetitive shows, some shows that I saw multiple places. I think that's just how this system works, right? You see a show that you really like it at state, or you see a show that you really like at another contest that you were a part of in previous years, and you're like, hey, I want to do that show. And so it's very common, but a lot of people are doing a lot of the same shows. And what I've noticed is that if you focus on your transitions and you focus on your kind of like in-betweens, right? Not just the transitions, but the stuff that happens in between the main portions of the text of the story, you're probably going to have a pretty strong show. That's just my kind of observation of how people are producing shows and the shows that have advanced. Yes, some of the beautifully tech-heavy shows are advancing, and that's great. It's great for tech, but you know, apparently this is a directing acting contest, although some of these shows, man, there were some shows I saw that had beautiful tech and I couldn't understand a single thing that was said in the story, or I could not. If you asked me, hey, what's the show about, I'd tell you no idea. But what I do know is that the it was stunning to look at and it advanced, right? Well, it may be because that was the icebreaker, right? That's the difference maker between a show that was okay and a show that was confusing, is that this one was prettier. I don't know, man, but there were some shows that were definitely confusing that still advanced, and I don't know if maybe because I needed to read the script, which I don't do. I don't know. I haven't yet mentioned who's the guest today. It's Stephanie Smith. Stephanie Smith is, again, one of those people that came recommended. I was super proud, or super, not proud, but super glad to get to know her. She was a really, really fun, high-energy interview that I know you're going to enjoy. If you like these interviews, they come out a little early on the Patreon, so you can join the Patreon to get these things a little early. It's really, really cheap. I'm going to try to produce more stuff on Patreon soon. I keep saying that to the people that are on Patreon, but I promise I'm going to do that. I just have to get less busy. It's crazy because I hate people that are always like, I'm so busy, I can't even poop, right? And I'm there right now. And so I'm blessed. I'm really grateful for it. But at the same time, some of the things that I really love to do, like this podcast, are kind of falling to the wayside. So because, I don't make money off of it. So BlakeMiner.com, hit me up at Blake.Miner@gmail.com if you want me to come to you next year. Again, the fall is starting to book up. I've got a couple shows, like full on, taking on the full thing with some of these clients. So hit me up, because I'd love to come to your school and I would love to help you out. I will even travel to Dallas, but let's make it smart. Enjoy Stephanie Smith this week. Buy a shirt, join Patreon. This is going to be a fun interview. I promise. I'll see you guys in a few weeks.
I guess I'll just talk a little bit about kind of my life in theater education, which has been all over the place. So I've wanted to be an educator, a theater educator specifically, since I was 8 years old, which I don't know if that's super typical or not, but I had a teacher in the third grade who put me in the little school play. I played a star, the kind of, not like the lead star, but like a cutout of a star with a little hole for my face. And I had one line. I remember my one line. My one line was, it was like a Christmas play, and I wasn't even like the main Christmas star. I was just like in a star squad. And my line was, wow, did you use some of that starshine polish? That was my one line, 8 years old. And I remember it causing like the audience to laugh, and it shocked me that I caused this reaction. And I was like, oh man, that was great. And I've literally done theater ever since. I remember that teacher's name. Her name was Miss Hirschfeld. And very much throughout my life, as I continued to perform, I remembered her and her effect she had on me. And I just thought that was magical. And so I knew that I wanted to be in education, and I knew that I wanted to work in theater education because of the impact it had on my life so young. I went to college, was a BFA acting major at Southwestern University, had a great time. But as I was nearing graduation, I remember going, I need a job. And I remembered Ms. Hirschfeld. I remembered all my great experiences as a kid in theater. And I was like, let's try the teaching thing. And so I got certified through my university and got hired. And it's fun because, I don't know, maybe she'll listen to this, but Linda Major from Leander High School had a huge impact. I was her student teacher in a year that I will not mention because I don't want to make her or me feel bad, but it was a long time ago. And as my mentor teacher, there was a job opening at Leander Middle School, and she recommended me for that position. And I interviewed with Eric Howe and was hired. And so I was the only person in my graduating class at Southwestern that had a job prior to graduating. Started teaching right away. I was a baby. I was 21. I knew nothing. Walked into a classroom and it was crazy. I cried in the bathroom every day, as I think a lot of first year teachers do. And was like, what have I done? This is the worst decision ever. Because it's just like, it's so stressful and it's so much, you know. It's like, teaching is emotionally and physically and mentally draining, and they can't really prepare you for that in school. So I just remember being exhausted, and I wanted so desperately to make an impact, and I felt like I wasn't. And so I was like, I'm not good at this. This is never going to happen. Eric Haug left about halfway through that year, my first year teaching, and Brett Champion, who later became the superintendent for Leander ISD, became my principal. And I remember crying on Brett's shoulder. I remember like weeping on him, and I would pull back away, and he would just have this big like tear stain mark down his jacket. And I was like, I'm so sorry. But he just kept saying, Stephanie, get back in there. Like, you can do this. He would come to class with me and help support me in the classroom. And I just remember going, maybe I'm trying too hard to make an impact. I was like, maybe I just need to relax and have fun with these kids. And the second I started to do that, things started to turn around. I remember going, we need to do a play. These kids haven't done a play in years. Let's just do a play. The play I chose was, of all plays, the Scottish play for middle school students. Why? I'm not really sure why that was my choice at 22, but it was. But it had a lot of fun stuff, right? There were witches and sword fights and whatever. And so I put these like pool noodles in these eighth grade boys' hands, and then I was their favorite teacher. So things turned around really quickly. And yeah, I did crazy things that first year. Like, we would do fundraisers and I would do the pie in the face. Like, as a first year teacher, I think you just are willing to do about anything. And then this is where my journey gets, kind of nuts, because I went with my sister to a, like a GRE grad school kind of job fair, basically, for grad schools. And I was bored because I was just there with my sister. It's like, I'm just going to go talk to some schools. So, you know, I talked to Yale and I talked to NYU. And as I was talking to NYU, they said, you know, what is it you do? And I said, I'm a teacher. I teach theater. They said, oh, we have a great theater education program, which they do at NYU. And then they said, what do you like specifically about teaching? And I said, you know what? I really love teaching my neurodivergent students. And they said, well, we have a program called drama therapy. And I had never heard of drama therapy in my life, but it's like everything went off in my head that it was kind of the coming together of everything I loved. It was about theater helping people, theater healing, like all those really great things. And I was like, that sounds interesting. So I auditioned. I'm kind of a risk taker. I'm one of those, why not? They only take 15 students, and I got in nuts and went to grad school at NYU for drama therapy. I got married and moved to New York, and I'd only been in New York City for 2 weeks and 9/11 happened. And I was studying in a therapeutic field. And so it was, just an incredible period of my life, where I realized truly that I've always known that theater was educational and theater as education was great and inspirational and all those things. But all of a sudden I was really opened up to the concept that theater can heal. And it was incredible. So that was an incredible 3 years of my life. And then I had this moment where I could have stayed working in drama therapy in New York and decided to have a family. And my husband and I did not want to raise our children in New York City. So we moved back to Texas and I went back to teaching. Again, I think teaching has always been such a stability thing. Like it's a solid contract with health benefits. So it just kind of made sense. And I worked at Travis High School down in Austin. And then I came back to Leander ISD. I opened Canyon Ridge Middle School and then I opened Rouse High School. So then I just taught like crazy while we had a family. I taught a lot. Opening schools is a whole thing. Very stressful. And then I got 20 years into my education career and my dad got really sick. He has Parkinson's, and theater education is a very time consuming job. And so it just sort of was, I was just curious one day, is there anything else out there for somebody with my skill set? Drama therapy, theater education. And I think a lot of teachers go, this is all I can do. So I got online and I put in all of my job skills, which when I looked at them, I was like, man, that's kind of niche. And one job came up and it was the education manager for the North Campus for Zach Theater, which was located in Cedar Park. And I went, you've got to be kidding. How is Zach Theater in Cedar Park? I never heard of it. And so I was like, well, let's, again, kind of like going to grad school. I was like, let's just apply. Let's see what happens. And I told people, I've applied, but nothing's going to come of it. Like, I'm not qualified. This is a ridiculous situation. And then they kept in there. I got a second interview and then a third interview. And on the third interview, I was like, oh, man, this might happen. I better decide if this is what I want to do or not. And so they offered me the job. And it was, I feel like kind of everything led me to this place in my life, because my job is currently arts administration within a performing arts school that is connected to a professional theater company. So it's kind of all the things I dreamed about doing, you know, professional theater, but also theater education. And there's a lot that I love about it. You know, it's definitely, the hours are infinitely better than when I was teaching public school. But I'm able to reach more kids. I think that for me has been the awesome part, is because our program at Zach North takes kids from all over Central Texas. I'm working with kids from all different schools. And I love it. At first I had kind of a crisis of faith because these kids are paying, you know, to come to these programs, but we offer so many scholarships. I've had some really awesome situations of being able to scholarship some kids in so that they can take part in the training, and that's been really cool. So now here I am, and I picked up some directing gigs. I'm taking an acting class, like, because I have this free time now. My job has become closer to a 9-to-5 type situation. I sort of feel like all my training kind of led to this. So now I work for Zach Theater in Austin, which is an incredible company to work for. I definitely feel like I had to restart my life, because it's a business, it's a non-for-profit business, which I knew nothing about how to run. So right away I was brought into these business meetings and they were talking about marketing and development. And I was like, yeah, guys, sounds great. But I had no concept of what any of that meant. So I just put on my actor face for the first few months and started figuring it out. But it is, it's great. I just think there's such a, I think the thing I did not know as a kid was that there were so many different ways to be involved in theater education other than just public school teaching. I was really surprised when I came into this position that there's theater education like what I'm doing happening in every major city in the country. I never would have dreamed. Had you asked me 15 years ago if I would be in arts administration, I would have been like, what are you talking about? So it's been quite the journey to get here, but I love it. I found my place, I think. It took a while, though. Here I am at 46. It took a while.
46,
that's
huh?
Part of my
yeah.
46.
All right. Well, you don't look a day over 26. So it must be the computer camera. There you go. So
my filters.
So that's really cool. So I took a lot of notes. Number one, I have to, I mean, because I've got kids as well, but I love what you said at the very, very beginning. I love the idea of a director or, you know, your mom or dad or whatever coming up to you and saying, as an 8-9-year-old kid, you're a star. And then you being like, no, literally, like you are playing a star, like you are a star in this Christmas play, not the star. I like that.
No, I just think that was the smallest role in the whole show.
Yeah.
But I had a really great cardboard cutout with glitter.
It's like false advertising.
Totally false.
Yeah.
I was led astray.
I also like you had a couple little phrases that you said that one of them is the crisis of faith. I can't relate to that any more than I am relating to it right now because of just my own personal situation of leaving the classroom, leaving a 9-to-5 and taking, and even on my computer that I'm looking at right now, I made a graphic that I titled Leap of Faith. Because it's just like me trying to put myself out there to freelance, right? And so it's right. That it's that same thing, but it's the crisis of faith of one of the things I told people that I wanted to do was I want to do this for free. I want to be able to do this, but I can't. You know, I've mouths to feed, dogs and children, you know, furry ones and less furry ones. But I would love to be able to go to a school and offer up services at no cost, but especially to the schools that I know can't afford it. But yeah, it's that crisis of faith. So how'd you get over it?
Right. Good question. Well, it's crazy that the transition out of public education and into this position, it was amazing how much kind of scrutiny I came under from, especially like, not to like talk about my family too much, but there was this, but you're a great teacher. What are you doing? Like, how can you leave the classroom? And that was, it was really, really tough for me, like emotionally to go through that transition. And, and then to be in a place where it's like a training program, it's like a performing arts school connected to a not-for-profit. There is this like money-making element, the sales element. But I think I've just seen so much good happen. You know, I think the scholarship thing helps a lot. We give a ton of money in financial aid. That helps a lot. And just to see what we're able to do, like, because we're able to give them so much attention and I'm able to work with so many different kids, like our programs are so big and all ages. Like now I work with kids 3 years old to 18. And so it's like, I'm able to follow and coach this kid from the time they're a little bitty one until the time I'm taking them to college auditions is kind of incredible. So I just think it's just kind of the person I am. I'm like, okay, if they're paying for this program, I'm going to give them 110% of myself, make sure that I'm getting them the best teachers, the best training, make it worth it. It's got to be worth it then. And so I say that all the time at my job. I'm like, cool, we're working on this curriculum. I'm building curriculum. Really, we're building curriculum right now, actually. We build new curriculum all the time. And every time we go in and dig into new curriculum, I'm like, cool. Is this going to be worth it for these kids? How much are they going to get out of it? Are they going to grow as humans? Are they going to grow as artists? You know, if they're going to pay money, then by God, the product better be awesome.
Yeah.
So that's how I started justify it. I think I just started digging into making sure the work I was doing was really high quality.
Yeah. And the other part of that I can relate to is the reaching more kids. You know, it's at the moment I'm struggling to decide if I want to go back to the classroom next year because honestly, am I making as much money? I don't know. Jury's still out, but I definitely know that I'm in a different school every day. I'm with different students, with different teachers. They can call me in a week to ask me more questions, 2 weeks, whatever. And I liken it to being a grandparent. I just say, hey, I'm here for 2 hours, and then you're back to mom and dad, And if grandpa needs to come back, that sounds creepy, but if grandpa,
I knew what you meant.
If grandpa needs to come back, but yeah, so it is a weird dichotomy that it's like, I'm actually affecting more people than I would have.
Well, I agree totally. Yeah. And I like to think that I'm also catching some kids that I might not have caught. Sure. I mean, the truth, and I think it's huge that I've spent so many years in public education. Like, I get it. There is no way as a high school public school teacher, I could have caught every single kid. I tried so hard, but the program had like 400 to 500 kids in it.
Yeah.
So I knew, you can't give all that solid attention to all 500 of them as much as you try. So I'd like to think that in this program, because it's spread across so many different schools, I might be able to catch a kid or two that their high school teachers aren't able to. It's not their fault. They're just so busy. So it's a way to catch more kids. Like, in a weird way, I feel like I think coming into this whole position, it was so important to me to want to support public school teachers because I know what they're going through. So that's been a lot of the process. Talk about how to fix the crisis of faith is like, okay, cool. I'm in this position. Can I use it for good kind of thing? So like, can I, in this position that I'm in, support teachers? And if so, what does that look like? What can I do for them? What can I provide for them? Right. So in that way, I've reached out to teachers before and been like, hey, if there's a kid in your program, they're not yet being cast in stuff. They're not at that place yet. And you're struggling with finding time to be able to train them like they need to be trained, send them my way because I can help and then send them back to you a little bit stronger, a little further down the path. So I think that's a little bit of that justification for like, how does this sit in my teacher heart?
Sure.
Is like, can I, in a weird way, not only catch more kids and be there for this diverse, huge array of kids, but also can I somehow give back to teachers by helping to support them? Is there a way in which I can do that? So that's been a lot on my mind, I think, since I took this job, is there a world in which I can do good for teachers too?
So I don't want to put you on the spot, but what is the mission of Zach?
Oh, that's such a great question. Well, in my onboarding, it's interesting that the mission is, the broad vision is that it's a theater by and for Austin. So it's like all about being deeply embedded in this community. And so you see that in like the works they do and in the artists they bring in and all that stuff, which is great. But here I am in this little Cedar Park, like Williamson County place. So I asked in the beginning, like, what's the purpose of this satellite campus? And, I think it is to support my own community, which is the Cedar Park, Round Rock, Leander.
Right.
So Leander ISD, Round Rock ISD are kind of where my focus is. How can I help and support that community? Because that's kind of my community, being a satellite campus. And then it's a lot. It's so crazy. Now we're going to get on an interesting topic here because it's art that is non-competitive. So it's very skills-based training. So I'm able to just break it down and all of our teachers, like in the training we do with them is we're teaching skills. So we're not about production or performance, we're about skills training. So it's like making sure that, if a kid comes in as a three-year-old, we're giving them the skills at every level to grow them along their journey as an artist outside of the concept of production and performance and competition. So that was a huge transition for me too. As a high school teacher, it was all about the competition. Yeah. If I wasn't holding a plaque in one hand and a trophy in the other by the end of the year, I was really upset about myself. It's so crazy to step out of that world and go, wait, let's just talk art. Let's just focus on the magic and the creativity and what you get out of just working on a scene today. Like, it may not even have a costume involved, but like just doing the scene work and how does that help me grow as an artist? That's been a huge mindset shift for me for sure. But I think a good one, and it's kind of nice to give students a place to train where it's not about production or competition. I think it's kind of nice for them to be able to step outside that world for a second and just do some scene work with a scene partner. And it's been interesting to watch, how healthy I think that is for them as young artists.
Do you think, because Amy Jordan always says, and this is not necessarily Amy Jordan's belief, but Amy Jordan always talks about how more and more kids get to Texas Thespians because there are more and more opportunities to show an administrator a trophy, a plaque, a medal around their neck, that kind of thing. And so we create contests that will allow for them to go home and say, look what I did. Even in the, you know, I had a student 2 years ago that won, or last year that won the knot tying contest, my last year teaching, or I shouldn't say last year, the last year that I taught, but you know, I had a student win knot tying and she was celebrated at the school like she had just won the Super Bowl. And she tied knots in 30 seconds or 17 actually, but you know, it was like, it's crazy how, the contest thing. I went to a performing arts high school, which I've said ad nauseum on this podcast, but, and we did not compete, in anything. And it was, you know, this was the 90s. And now that school competes in our, Heller's, the Tommy Toon Awards. Right. And there are a lot of people that have mixed feelings about it. I understand why they do it, because the kids at that school feel left out when they see their peers who they went to middle school with, who are now at quote-unquote public schools, even though HSPVA is public. They see their friends winning awards that they aren't eligible to win, so they started entering these contests, right? And but the double-edged sword is that the performing arts school should win. Because why would you go to this specialized school if it's not the best, right? So anyway, it's a weird thing, but yes, competition. As we chat now, we're, you know, starting to get the UIL One Act Play snowball rolling. You know,
rolling. Yes. Yeah.
What?
Well, it's crazy because like I love the competition, and yeah. And I absolutely agree with you and Amy. That I do think there's an incredibly important place for it in public education for sure. And there is this, like, you know, the celebration, the legitimizing of what you do to administration, things like that. And I think it has interestingly like elevated the level of performance and performance training and resources. I mean, I think it's all of that is so great. It is just kind of interesting that when I stepped outside of it and into this different position, like people always ask me like, why would I ever go to a training program outside of my high school, because high school teachers are amazing. Like their ability to train their kids is bar none. So it's not like they can't train their kids, but we just provide like a different atmosphere for them to experience a kind of different way of doing this whole thing called theater. So the non-competition element just makes it a little bit different, I think. But man, when I was teaching, you better believe I was gunning for me some plaques.
Yeah, well, I get it.
And I love the Heller Awards. Yeah, for sure. I know. We're coming up on nomination day for Heller Awards. That's soon.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. You just quickly said something that got that I preach a lot too. And I'm not a director. I don't ever claim to be a director. I don't mind directing. I will never direct a drama. But but I would always, you know, in a school with two or three or even sometimes four, like not to rhyme with Heller, but like the Keller schools have 27 directors in their programs. You know, not really they, but you know, but anyway, I would, my students, when I was teaching would always wonder why I would be directing a show. And I'm not that good. And I would say, hey, I'm not that good, but we're going to have a good time. We're going to put on a good show, but you know, you're not going to learn these secret ways to get the emotion to spit out of your system because I'm going to teach you these, you know, the Raza boxes or anything like that. But it was different. And, right. And the education isn't necessarily that I'm directing a show. It's that the experience is different and that you will rarely work with the same director over and over and over and over. Yes, you might a couple times, right? But you're never going to work with that same director for every show for 4 years. That's just not how. So I like your point though, that the reason you would go to a Zach Theater or hear, you know, Tuts or Main Street or is just to get a different perspective. So it's not that one is doing it wrong or right. It's just different. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, you're exactly right. And the ability to work with different directors too. Well, and a lot of it, like I thought so much about, you know, I feel like as a high school teacher, there. And in this program I'm into now, I also train seniors. So there's always this concept of like, we're working with these kids, but some of them are going to want to go try to do this, like, and make a living out of it. So am I training them to be able to like take that next step?
Right.
And the more experiences we can get them, the better they will, the more open they will be when they get to college or get out into the world as to what this whole thing actually looks like.
Right. So I wrote, again, I've got more stuff. Excuse me. What was your high, you kind of, when you were talking about your journey, you skipped over high school.
Oh, I did.
Yeah. Where did you go to high school?
It's so sad because it doesn't exist anymore, which is so sad. I know. I went to Notre Dame High School in Wichita Falls, Texas.
Oh.
Studied under Kathy Harvey, who's a pretty big UIL judge these days.
Right.
Kathy's done a lot. And it was amazing. It was teeny tiny. Went to a little private school in Wichita Falls, Texas.
Okay.
And did a ton of stuff. It was such a small program that we did. I mean, we did everything. I was like in theater. I was the captain of the dance team. I played the flute in the band. Like, you know, it was just a crazy type of thing. So we did everything. It was super, super busy. But yeah, it was a great time. And I loved Kathy. Kathy is another huge influence on me becoming a theater educator for sure.
So that you said that was a private school?
Yes. Okay. But it's since been torn down. I can't believe it.
Is it just because funded? Like, what do you know why it was?
Well, it's super controversial, but it was a Catholic school. I know, right? Not to segue to the Catholic Church, but it was a Catholic school, and the diocese decided to shut it down. And there's a lot of speculation as to why, but I don't know that anyone knows the true answer.
Interesting. Juicy. All right. Yeah. That's fun.
You're so juicy. I know.
Okay. With Linda Major, I've had quite a few people talk about I don't know how much of a football fan you are, but there are all these, you know, the Bill Belichick tree and the, you know, like the tree of coaches that have come from this one source. Linda Major seems to be that kind of like source, right? That all these people have kind of branched off of her sort of wisdom, I guess, and leadership. So I don't have a question there. I just was pointing it out, but yeah.
Yeah, no, that is absolutely true. And it just interesting. In connection to that, my husband went to high school at Leander High School and was taught by Linda. So it's like she is kind of like, it's like Kevin Bacon, like somehow you're connected to Linda Major. But yeah, she was amazing as my mentor teacher. I remember, it's just a cute side story about Linda. My first day was 1999. I'll go ahead and say it. There we go. Right. 1999, my first day student teaching, I showed up in my precious little skirt suit ready to teach. And she said, all right, 70, you're going to take over second period. They'll be here in 30 minutes. Here's your roster. And I was like, what's happening? I was like, Linda, I don't know if I'm ready for that. And she was like, you're ready. And I was like, what? But what was amazing about that was she was just like, there's no way to learn how to teach unless you just get in there and start doing it. And then we can talk about it. And she was there for me every step of the way, but it was very much a off to the wolves you go kind of experience. I actually directed a show while I was student teaching with Linda, went with them to one act play contest. It was an incredible way to learn about public education. And we stayed friends. We're friends to this day.
Yeah. She's great. Was your connection, had you met your now husband by that time or? Okay. So,
yes.
So was there any sort of influence in that you went to go work with his theater team? Like, how did that?
It was more, yes, and it was more than that. So at Southwestern University, there was a squad of like Leander High School graduates.
Gotcha.
So Jill, her name then was Jill Crowley, and now Jill performs at Zach all the time. Mandy Shy, Jeremy Cottrell, there was this whole group of people at Southwestern that came from that program.
Gotcha.
So when I went to student teach, there was no question. Matter of fact, most Southwestern students were being placed in Georgetown schools. But I said, I want to go to Leander High School. And they said, that's kind of a drive. And I was like, I really don't care. I have to go to Leander High School. Yeah. And so they placed me there.
My high school tech director, who probably was gone by the time you got to Georgetown or got to Southwestern, was, I guess, the tech director at Southwestern or some sort of tech position. But Stephen Wolf was there in the early 90s, I guess. But I don't know where he is. We joke that he's probably doing some things he shouldn't be doing on a couch somewhere in the Austin area, because that's just, you know, none of us, we all know where our other teachers are from the HSPVA world. We know where Susie Phillips is or Susie Jennings, Bob Singleton. We know where these people are, except for Stephen Wolf. And it's almost a contest with a bunch of graduates to find it's like, you know, Where's Waldo or something like that. But yeah. Couple other things. And then, you know, cause it's a school night. have you ever used the idea of theater as therapy to advocate to people that might not understand that it's necessary?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay. Honestly, that's one of the strongest things I think that coming out of NYU, I mean, NYU's it's an incredible school. Right. The people that I learned from were just brilliant. And so I definitely came out of that program very fired up about theater being so much more than just this fun, entertaining thing we do. And so, yes, I think when it comes to advocacy, which now, like I said, in the position I'm in, I've become such a theater advocate. And it's, I think my training with theater being healing comes into play all the time. Sure. It's like, you know, this isn't just cute, you guys. Like, there's so much more to it than that. I mean, theater literally can change lives. And, you know, the ability for us to role play, to step outside ourselves, to have empathy for others. I mean, it's not to go down another rabbit hole, but, you know, this whole concept of AI has become such a thing. And it's like, well, what's the thing that we do that AI can't do? And it's this concept of empathy and, you know, what makes us human. And theater absolutely addresses what makes us human, our very essences of humanity. So, yeah, I think the fact that theater can actually be healing for a person or a community is huge. Like the fact that I was studying drama therapy during 9/11, like it wasn't just about healing a person. It was about healing a city, healing a nation. It was about our ability to process trauma. And, you know, it was amazing. I got to watch that play out the 3 years I was in New York. So yeah, I talk about that all the time, probably to the point that people get real bored, but that is, I think, hugely important as we talk about the importance of theater in education. Is it's not just about training people to put on a costume. It's about training people to be good people.
Right. When you were in New York, where did you live?
I lived, well, multiple places, but always in Brooklyn. I lived in the Park Slope area of Brooklyn.
Okay. What was your sort of, what's your memory of 9/11? It's not something I really ever talk about on here. It's not something that comes up very often, but it's for, you know, our generation, it's the day, right? It's our JFK. Yeah. It's our, well, I was about to say Lincoln, but nobody's alive that remembers that. But you know, what was your kind of, in without getting into emotional retelling of the story, but what was your story a little bit?
Well, it's funny because I don't talk about it a lot because to the students it immediately identifies me as old. Like that's like their thing. If you remember 9/11, that means you're old. So I don't talk about it a ton, but it was absolutely, to me, I mean, I was 24, 25. And so it was the moment I grew up, honestly, that I realized that life rocked my whole world. Because I was in New York, it rocked that, I mean, it rocked the planet, but it rocked that community so intensely. I stood on the street, watched the whole thing happen in my pajamas, because we lived right off Flatbush. So when you looked down Flatbush Avenue, there was like a direct view of the World Trade Towers. So we just stood there like in some sort of crazy movie, like people had just stopped their cars and they had gotten out. We were all just kind of, it was quiet and we were just watching. But to me, like my experience of 9/11, like that moment for sure was a whole thing, but it was so much more about the days after and like watching people come together. The fire station that was in our neighborhood lost every single person. So we, you know, lit candles and brought food for their families. And it was just this like kind of crazy thing where we've all experienced this massive trauma. So we immediately felt the need to reach out to each other. Which that, like, those are the memories that have stuck with me, honestly, more than anything else. It's like all those moments of reconnecting as a community. I was in school. So there was this, do we want to have class? I remember like right after, like within 3 days or so, you know, back in the day, all we had was email. There was, I may have had a cell phone, but I don't know if it's flip phone, but we emailed and there was this, like, do we want to have class or not? And everybody responded, yeah, we'd been misplaced. There were people in hotels because the dorms, NYU's dorms were right in that area. So people everywhere. And we were like, yeah, we do, because there was such a need to reconnect to people.
Yeah. I had, because I had some friends at NYU at that exact time. I say Eleanor because that's my daughter's name, but Nell Tier was, I don't remember if she was at the Tisch School or where she was, but Courtney Sauls, a couple people that were, and they were just like right there. I mean, their dorms were there. If they were on the ground, it would have been a different story than them being up in their dorm. So, but it's,
my friend Katie left her because they were just getting all the students out.
Yeah.
She had no shoes. She had no, like, she had nothing.
Yeah.
And NYU actually provided funds for all those displaced people to get clothes and toothbrushes and stuff like that.
And, not to change subjects harshly, but, you know, this is how my brain works, but you mentioned about NYU being a good school. And I immediately thought, you know, I think with theater people, I don't think a lot of theater people realize NYU is like UH. It's like UT. It's like, it's a school that just happens to have, you know, a really stellar theater department that we know it as the place to go for theater. But it's also a university that has science and, you know, math and business and, you know, all that stuff.
But, it's true. Yeah. And actually my experience at NYU was so interesting. First of all, it is just a school. I remember when I got in, I was like shocked. Like, is that possible? Can I go to NYU? Do people go to NYU? Something. But when I got there, for sure. It's just like a fully functioning school. But my program, drama therapy, was interesting because it was situated in like a weird, they didn't really know where to, like what school to put it in, because NYU has multiple different programs. So I kind of got to experience a little bit of several different departments at NYU, and that was great. Like, I was taking psychology classes and also acting classes. I did this little show while I was at NYU, like, because one of the professors was, we did a movement exercise and she was like, you should come be in the show. I was like, okay. So it was such a cool experience being in the drama therapy program because it was connected to so many different places. But NYU is, 100% just a school. I mean, you never know because it's enmeshed in the city. So when you walk around, you don't really even know you're in the middle of the campus. But it's, massive school. My graduation was in Madison Square Garden, if you can imagine.
Oh,
and
wow.
It was packed. Yeah.
I've heard horror stories. I've never been in Madison Square Garden. I've been in the train station, you know, the one that's kind of under Madison Square Garden, but I've never been in it. And I'm a big wrestling, as you can see behind me, I don't know how lit they are, but I'm a big wrestling fan, and that's kind of like the mecca of wrestling. So I need to go one day. But I've heard like horror stories about the transportation element of Madison Square Garden. Like, it's just like, it's either a train or it's nothing, or, you know, that, or a subway, or, you know, people trying to drive there. It's just not going to work. But
that's insane.
Yeah. So, I've got two more things. One is kind of a topic that we can either cut out or not, but, and then the other one is not, but it's the, how I'll end with you. But, I almost said how I'll end you. That would have been horrible, but this podcast didn't know you signed a waiver.
Just need to let my husband know. So, see you later, babe.
Yeah. Weird podcast, weird format.
See you on the flip side.
So my father had Parkinson's, and so when you said that, every time I hear somebody that talks about their experience with Parkinson's, I bring it up, and, you know, the obviously the one that everybody knows is Michael J. Fox and such, but I kind of am just curious about your experience with that disease, because mine is, my family, I won't say the word, but we're an effed up family that, like, we just treated everything with comedy, and everything was, you know, everything was fun. Like, to the point, I've told this story before as well. I don't know if I've told on this podcast, but, my father, he passed away in 2006. So it's been almost 20 years, but he would, when it got bad for him, the Parkinson's, he would order soup on purpose just because of the comedy. And, you know, in mixed company, or just he and I going to have lunch or dinner or whatever, he would get soup, and it was some of the funniest stuff, but also, like, you know, when the waiter or waitress would come by and there's just soup on the table, you know, you're like, well, it's hard to explain, but anyway, you don't have to get too deep into it, 'cause I know it can be kind of emotional, but I mean, like, what is your kind of experience with that, and how have you kind of twisted it to be a learning experience, a positive experience for you?
100%. Well, it's I am 100% my father's child. Yeah. Like, he was such a vibrant personality. He's a courtroom lawyer. He did theater in high school and college. Ended up going the law route and was just like dazzling, like Billy Flynn in the courtroom. I mean, just spectacular courtroom lawyer. So yeah, totally heartbreaking to see this like person who's so charismatic and such a great public speaker. Cause a lot of people don't know Parkinson's affects your ability to speak a lot.
Right.
And so that I think was has been the biggest loss. Interestingly, my family is very similar. We deal with everything with humor.
Yeah.
So for sure, as much as we can make it funny, we do. But it's crazy. I feel like life sometimes does this to you where it just kind of rocks you a little bit.
Yeah.
And it absolutely was, he had just had a hip surgery, and with Parkinson's, whenever you're recovering from a surgery, it's brutal.
Yeah.
And so we were on rotation, you know, my sister was sitting up with him. I was sitting up with him, my mom. So we were just like on rotation.
Right.
So here I am in this like middle of the night, like staring at him. It's 3 a.m. And I was like, my family needs to be more important to me than it has been.
100%.
And it was just like, it hit me like a bolt of lightning
yeah.
that life cannot just be about being a theater teacher. There's gotta be a place for family, for myself. What? Who's that? Like, yeah. It was just kind of this boat rocking moment. And that's when I kind of looked up this job, and it was the impetus for me to take this position, because I work from home a couple days a week. So I'm able to, they're still in Wichita Falls. I'm able to drive up and help if they need anything. Cause at this point he's getting pretty late stage, pretty wheelchair bound, those kinds of things. And so my ability to be there for my family became a bigger priority. So I think what good has come out of it is it definitely has brought my sisters and I closer, my family closer. And I don't make decisions now that are just based on my job, which I did a lot. And I think a lot of teachers do. I think a lot of teachers put their job over almost everything else. And so it was a really important moment for me to go, yes, I'm a teacher. Yes, that's important. And yes, I'm going to do everything I can for my kids and my job, but my family's got to take a higher seat.
Yeah.
So that I think was the positive that came out of it for me, but it is so hard. I mean, he really can't storytell anymore. And he's such a storyteller, but what happened is my sisters and I have just picked up the storytelling gauntlet. So now we tell his stories, you know, so it kind of worked out.
Yeah. That's great. So you said a like courtroom lawyer, like Billy Flynn. So like, I mean, what was that like growing up with that? Because that's a very time consuming job, right? But it's also like, it's like you said, it's kind of cool. It's kind of like, that's not a job that a lot of people have. So, what was that like for you, especially being somebody that is theatrical and active, and you yourself are a good storyteller. You don't mix words, you know, you kind of get to the point whereas I'm rambling and mumbling and stuff, but, you know, what was that like for you to have that sort of, I don't want to say your back pocket, but you know what I mean? Like living with this kind of commodity, I guess, if you will.
For a charismatic guy. Yeah, it was crazy. Well, and I'm going to take it even further. Kind of love that we're talking about my dad. He's one of my favorite humans on the planet.
Yeah.
He was a rock star courtroom lawyer by day, jazz musician by night.
What'd he play?
The piano.
Okay.
And still can a little bit play the piano, which is kind of cool. So yeah, my dad, in my head as a little kid, my dad was an absolute rock star.
Right.
Like there was no famous person cooler than my dad. And so what was interesting was, we saw him very little. Like he would come home late at night. I remember laying in bed when I was like little bitty, bitty kid and like seeing the headlights pull up and going, oh, he's home. Cause he would always come in and he would always come to my room and my sister's room and tell us some sort of, and his stories were great because he would make them up, and sometimes they were real and sometimes they were not, but like, I loved, you know, dad's story time.
Yeah.
And he did it literally every single night, but he sometimes didn't get home until super, super late. So, I have those memories. It just made like the time that we got to spend with him felt so special because it was a little bit rare. And like, he made a point of every Saturday morning, we would go to McDonald's, which explains a lot about my issues with fast food. But every Saturday morning, we would go get pancakes at McDonald's. I don't know if you know, but McDonald's has pancakes.
Yeah, good ones.
And, Yeah, and like I have such solid memories of that time. But man, yeah, he'd play the piano and we'd dance around the house. My mom would be cooking and my sister and I would dance around. I mean, it was great. I really got lucky in the childhood growing up department for sure. But yeah, no, he always was such an idol to me as a kid. And I knew he had done theater. I think a lot of why I was so proud as a performer was like, I do feel like it connected me to my dad a little bit. But yeah, he won state poetry when he, back in the day, UAL poetry, and I won state poetry my senior year of high school. So we have the kind of this weird, like, parallel. Yeah, we can tell a story, me and my dad, for sure.
So do you think that, I mean, I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask you anyway, because maybe you have a different answer, but do you think that the theater background for your father is what made him such a strong courtroom lawyer?
Oh yeah, without a doubt, for sure. I mean, he was so charismatic, and I think so much of that was his theater background. He was an amazing public speaker, super charismatic, and super smart. I mean, I think that people like theater also teaches you to think really quickly on your feet, and as a courtroom lawyer, I think that was important. Right. I think a lot of theater people I know, like from my college program and from growing up, a lot of theater people I know became lawyers. I think it is actually, interestingly, a solid foundational skill set for that career, for sure.
Preach it. Yeah. Scream that from the mountaintops right there. But yeah, my grandfather was a jazz trumpet player and smoked cigars until he was 80, and he got lung cancer at 80. He survived it. He was fine, which is crazy, but he smoked cigars from 16 to 80. And the reason he started at 16 is because he wasn't able to get into jazz clubs to play trumpet unless he looked older. And so the cigar made him, quote unquote, older, right? Appear older, but it's crazy. Yeah. So we've got that. So I want to get you out of here on this. You quickly again mentioned trying too hard to make an impact as an educator, right? You kind of hit a chord because I've talked to literally hundreds of teachers now for this podcast, and I think a lot of times, especially in Texas, to bring this full circle with the competitive element of things, is you either find yourself trying way too hard to and you've actually touched on this theme a little bit throughout, but you try way too hard to reach every kid, and to, you know, like you said, if you're in a department that has 300, 400, 500 kids, you just can't. And so I think there are a lot of younger teachers that have that syndrome of, I'm going to keep dating this person because I'm going to fix them, right? It's that same mentality. What is some advice that you have for how you kind of eventually got over that and were able to deal with not needing to feel like you have got to, for lack of better words, fix or make an impact for every single student that was in your department?
Well, I'm going to answer this by quoting one of my professors from NYU, because therapists go through a very similar thing where you have your clients and you want to fix them. You want to somehow make it all better. And she said to me, we were super stressed one day. I was in my internship, so I had clients I was seeing, and I just could not. I felt like I wasn't making a dent, I feel like I was making it worse. And she said to me, she was like, Stephanie, we are a wave, we are not the ocean. And at the time I was like, man, what a crappy thing to say. I was like, I want to be the ocean. But the truth is that what we don't realize is that we are having such a huge impact just by being present with these kids, just by showing up every day and saying, hey kids, I'm here for you. Let's do some theater together. Like, I feel like just that simple fact of being there for them sometimes, like what I think we don't realize that is huge. You know, I had a student one time, I just thought he hated my class. And I'm sure a lot of people have had similar students where the class would kick off and he would put his head on the desk and he would fall asleep. And I was like, buddy, I am entertaining. I'm up here tap dancing. How am I not entertaining? And it became like a mission. I was like, man, I am going to get this kid today. He's going to love what we're doing. And I was pulling out all the stops. We're going to group juggle. We're going to like any activity I could think of. I was like, this is going to make an impact. And he just every single day. And so finally, I just went up to him and I was like, hey, are you okay? Like, I know you might not be loving theater. It's the theater one class. I'm like, maybe you have to take this for a credit. I was like, I just feel so bad because I feel like, you know, you're not having a good time in my class. And he was like, no, he's like, I love your class. I was like, but you sleep through the whole thing. But I found out that he, you know, was a 16-year-old kid who was taking care of all of his younger siblings. He was working a job overnight. And so he literally was only sleeping 2 or 3 hours. And so I said, all right, here's the deal. I'm cool if you want to sleep. If every once in a while you could do an activity, that'd be cool. And he's like, yeah. And it was weird because when we talked, he knew everything I had taught. He was like, no, I love that lesson about pronunciation. And I was like, what? You're like, how did you really? And so I had this moment where I was like, man, I've been trying so hard. And really the fact that, you know, I was just here for this kid and not forcing him to do a bunch of stuff. And I was just accepting the fact that he might be a little sleepy that day. I was having an impact. So I feel like sometimes we're trying so hard to have an impact that we don't realize some of the teeny tiny things are actually making huge impacts. We just may not know it. And like, all I want to tell first year teachers is this, just wait, just give it some time. At some point you're going to have an alumni student 20 years down the road, contact you and say, hey, I remember you. Thank you so much. And that's the crack cocaine. That's all you need. Like, then you realize, oh man, okay. It was all worth it. I just think we're trying so hard to have the big impact. I think we need to pay attention to the little things and literally just showing up and being there for them. I mean, that alone is huge. Minor Wisdom.